Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
How does a will become a former Russian spy will? Does it tear up its membership card? Does it start speaking another language? How does it report back to the Russian security services? What were the circumstances in which it resigned from the service? Or is it no longer a will? Answers on a postcard, please, or on the Twitter, or even on the telephone lines. I mention it only because it does indeed show the depths of absurdity to which the hysterical mendacity of the lie machine that is the Western media has sunk. The same BBC apparently alleged that Roger Waters had a balloon of a pig flying above his concert in Berlin, adorned with the Star of David, the Jewish religious symbol. It was a complete lie, as 1,000 pictures of the pig from all angles make clear. No such horrific image was ever present in the auditorium. It is telling that such a brazen and gigantic and, I believe, grave defamation could be carried on the British state mouthpiece BBC without consequence, without an apology, without a retraction. The claim is still there, I'm told. And yet, in a way, we can be shocked but not surprised. The effort that is being made to destroy the reputation and destroy the career of the legendary Pink Floyd singer, songwriter, and musician is truly mind-blowing. It is Jeremy Corbyn to the power of 10. It is an international effort to destroy someone for no other reason than that he has dared to speak up from the considerable platform that he commands against pet narratives of the Western oligarchies on the war in Ukraine, on the attempt to invade and occupy and destroy the Syrian Arab Republic, and on the issue of Israel-Palestine. They try to tell you that Roger Waters is a fascist. I read it all day and every day. Roger Waters' father died fighting fascism in Italy in the Second World War. Roger Waters has written and performed some of the most magnificent anti-fascist music that the English-speaking world has ever seen. And that's why he's packing them out all over the world on this tour, and he's in his 70s. Sorry, Roger, if you didn't want that to be known. This man is an icon, a hero to tens, maybe hundreds of millions of people. In Sao Paulo in Brazil, they've just had to put on an extra night. So many people wanted to pack into the auditorium there. In Berlin, he performed a part of his show that he and Pink Floyd before him have performed for decades, called The Wall. You get it? Another brick in the wall. It is an anti-fascist parody, particularly appropriate in Berlin, of all places, I would have thought. Both ancient and modern Berlin, both 1933 to 1945 Berlin and 2023 Berlin. But up went a hue and cry to try again to cancel his concert in Frankfurt. It failed, and Frankfurt turned in a magnificent, packed audience, not a seat to be had at any price, and gave Roger Waters their support. Why am I dwelling on this? Because it shows the desperation of the prevailing orthodoxy, but also how it is failing, failing, failing on every front. We're asking in the poll, is Roger Waters being smeared? Overwhelmingly, you all can see it, that he is being smeared. Why mention that? Because it shows how paper thin, as thin as a beluga whale's skin, is the prevailing narrative in the so-called Western world today. Tito, in the chorus, the cat's chorus of journalism isn't a crime, as they keep singing every time they all issue a tweet about a journalist imprisoned in Russia or journalism in general. Journalism is not a crime, they sing, these hyenas. Not mentioning that in a London jailhouse, Belmarsh Dungeon, rots the world's greatest journalist, Julian Assange, another thing that Roger Waters ceaselessly campaigns on. But at least you could say, well, Julian Assange is Australian. He's wanted by the Americans. But Kit Clarenberg is British. He's a British citizen who landed at London Luton Airport just a few days ago. London in the grip of a crime wave, where if you send your teenage children out on the street to buy a loaf, you're a fool, because the chances of them coming back in a box or bleeding, having been stabbed or shot, are so terribly high. A crime wave that the Metropolitan Police cannot get on top of. Six of the Metropolitan Police's finest plainclothes officers, six of them, were waiting at the foot of the aircraft steps to pounce on a British journalist, a regular guest on this show, Kit Clarenberg. Well, they questioned him for 5 hours in an interrogation room under the anti-terrorism laws, asking him his views on, inter alia, Rishi Sunak. Well, I don't know if Kit has any views at all. Does anybody even care about Rishi Sunak? Six police officers interrogating a journalist about his political views, seizing his property under the Anti-Terrorism Acts, copying everything on his computer, his phone, God knows what else they did with it, interrogating him about his views on this political issue or that. Kit should have told them to get stuffed. They wanted to arrest him. Go ahead. He should never have spoken to them for 5 hours, in my view. But he's a decent citizen, was trying to be helpful to the Metropolitan Police's finest. These people who tell you journalism is not a crime are seizing journalists. They seized a French journalist at St. Pancras Station just a few weeks before and interrogated him on his attitude to President Macron. Thank God they didn't interrogate me on that subject, or half of England for that matter. What business is it of the Metropolitan Police what Kit Clarenberg thinks about Rishi Sunak? Unless, of course, we have now officially become a police state. I can live with that because I don't live there. Be a police state if you want to. But don't at the same time pretend that you're a free country, that you're a democratic country, that you're in fact fighting wars and getting ready to fight more for freedom and democracy. That just makes you a complete hypocrite. Capital H, hypocrite. And nobody wants to be a citizen or even a subject of a country whose middle name is hypocrisy. The Americans have let it be known that they do not approve of American weaponry and war material being used by the Ukrainian regime to mount attacks on old age pensioners and people tending their allotments on Russian territory. Joe Biden said it was an escalation too far. Macron says, look, we need to negotiate with President Vladimir Putin. We live in a country in Britain which thinks the opposite. James Cleverly, the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain, in the past, a personal friend of mine across the political aisle, he stated in public, bluntly, that Kiev was right to launch military attacks on the Kremlin to kill the president of the Russian Federation. Military attacks on the gardeners in the allotments. Drone attacks on old age pensioners' housing on the outskirts of Moscow. James Cleverly supports that in public. This is a declaration of war, James. As former President Medvedev made clear, this now makes you, and sadly us, the British, a party to the conflict. If it's legitimate to launch attacks on Putin in the Kremlin, it's legitimate to launch an attack on Rishi Sunak in number 10 Downing Street. Don't you see the road that you have gone down and where it leads? Don't you see that it takes two to tango? That if you've declared war on Russia, they're going to declare war on you? Or are you too uncleverly to fully understand that? Now, I don't want to see Rishi Sunak with a missile, a caliber, going down his chimney pot in Downing Street. No, not least because it would harm and kill people I know that work there as police officers and so on. I don't want to see one of these missiles go down the chimney in King Charles Street of the British Foreign Office. Ditto for the same reason. And also, I wouldn't like to see Mr. Cleverly harmed. But if you are openly, publicly exhorting someone to kill the president of another country, for how long do you think that other country will remain sanguine about you in your fastness in Westminster and Whitehall? Are we led by fools or knaves? And which would be worse? I suppose we could be being led by knavish fools, and perhaps we are. They try to tell you on the BBC that Kosovo is a country. But it is not a country. It has never been a country. It isn't even recognized by members of the European Union as a country. It isn't even recognized by some members of NATO as a country. Countries like Spain have got a problem with the idea that a small part of somebody else's country can declare themselves to be a separate country and get the recognition of the big powers in the Western world for obvious reasons. They never answer me when I ask this simple question. If Kosovo can be declared by NATO as a separate country, why can't Crimea? Why can't the Donbass? Why can't Lugansk, Donetsk? Why can't Kherson? Why can't Odessa? Why can't anybody anywhere declare themselves to be an independent country and gain the recognition of the big belligerent powers in the Western world? They can't answer that question because it has no answer. But the vast majority of countries in the world do not recognize a country called Kosovo, including the United Nations doesn't recognize it either and never will recognize it. On what basis then are the NATO forces in what is effectively an illegal occupation of a part of Serbia? Kosovo is in Serbia. That fact will never change. And I know the Serbian people rather well as it happens. I've yet to meet a Serbian who would not give his life's blood to defend the sovereignty of what remains of the once magnificent, multicolored, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-religious wonder that was Yugoslavia. Serbia is the last man standing. And if anyone thinks they're going to go quietly into the destruction of the small state of Serbia, they know nothing about Serbians. We'll be talking in the course of the next 1 hour and 40 minutes to two experts, Professor Glenn Deason, who's an expert on Yugoslavia, on Serbia, on Kosovo, and as I said, the one and only Scott Ritter, former Marine Intelligence Corps officer, arms inspector, who tried to stop the war on Iraq and who has in vain so far, but valiantly trying through no fault of his own to stop a world war erupting over the territory and the bodies of the Ukraine. All that and much, much more coming up on the Mother of All Talk Shows.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, I've been trying to stop wars with Scott Ritter for more than 20 years, getting on for 25 years. It's not going that well, but not for the want of both of us trying. Scott Ritter, former Marine intelligence officer, a man who knows the horrors of war, has just returned from Russia, where he was touring for peace. Let's hear, first of all, how that went. Scott, welcome back to the Mother of All Talk Shows. More and more Americans, by the way, are choosing to stay in Russia. I see my good friend Tara Reid, the whistleblower from Joe Biden's private office, has now decided to go and live there. Mr. Snowden, of course, the whistleblower of note, who has told us so much about how the security state spies on us and sets us up in various ways, and some others that I've seen recently, actors and the like. Your reception in Russia seemed to be a good one. Did you ever think of staying?
Absolutely not. I mean, the reception, of course, was very good. But I'm an American. I'm an American patriot. This is my country. I love my country. And I defend my country. And there's various ways of defending your country. And one of the best ways of defending your country is to try and fix it when it's broken. And America's broken right now. But as an American patriot, my my duty and responsibility is to stay here at home and try to fix that which is wrong, to try to cure that which ails us, not to run away. I'm not denigrating the choices made by others. Free will is a thing. But my my duty, my responsibility, my loyalties are to the United States of America. That doesn't mean that I can't travel to places like Russia, seek to reach out to the Russian people to get a better understanding of the Russian nation, of the Russian soul, to capture that experience and to bring it back to the United States in an effort, an uphill effort, but an effort nonetheless to try and change the mindset in this country about Russia so that we don't waste our resources, squander our efforts in futile and dangerous conflict with Russia where none needs exist. You know, we'd be better off turning our efforts inward to fix the many problems that exist in this country and to find a way to live in peace and harmony with the Russian nation, which is a great nation populated by a great people.
Amen. Where did you go and what did you do there?
Well, the primary mission of this visit was a book tour. I've written a book, Disarming the Time of Perestroika, that not only I think captures a very important time in history, that is the implementation of the first ever nuclear disarmament treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And I remind people that not only did we get rid of nuclear weapons, but it was done in an environment that in some ways parallels the tension that exists today, in other ways exceeds it. It was a vein, you know this, George, you know, in the 1980s, how dangerous it was between the United States and the Soviet Union. And yet, through the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, through arms control, we found a way to come together and work cooperatively as friends, even to get rid of these weapons. So the book isn't just a piece of history. I call it a template of hope. When people say, how can we get out of this mess that we're currently in? I say, we have an example, my book. And book was published in Russian by Komsomolskaya Pravda. And I had the opportunity to go to Russia on a tour, an extensive tour, 12 cities over the course of 26 days and bring this book to the Russian people. And in doing so, engage in some very meaningful conversations. You know, it's not an easy topic. The Russians feel betrayed by the West. There is not the trust that used to exist. There's a lot of bad feeling between the Russian people and the governments of the West. But there's also a lot of kindness in their hearts and a willingness to work with the people of the United States, the people of the West. So I went to Novosibirsk, third largest city, fastest growing economy in Russia. If anybody thinks sanctions is having an impact on Russia, I'm just here to tell you that it's not. I witnessed a vibrant, vigorous, thriving nation. The economic engine's in full swing. There's construction everywhere. It's a nation that's alive, that's thriving. I went to Irkutsk, the history and the beauty of that part of Siberia, St. Petersburg. I've never been there before, and every stone in that city is soaked in the blood of people who died in the revolution, people who died during the Second World War. It's a city that screams history. You have to see the city to understand Russia. I went to Moscow. I was in Moscow during the Victory Day parade. It's not a propaganda exercise. It's a genuine expression of the patriotism of the Russian people. And that was made clear to me by what I saw. I traveled to Ekaterinburg, a place where, of course, Tsar Nicholas and his family were killed. It's, you know, one of the largest growing economies in Russia today. It's home of tremendous industry and history. I got to go back to Vodkensk, where it all began, the city where the arms control treaty was implemented, where I spent 2 years of my life going there. Kazan, you want to talk about some interesting, I went to Kazan and Grozny, two Muslim nations, and the relationship between the Orthodox Russians, deeply religious people, and the Muslims of Tatarstan and Chechnya are amazing. What, you know, they live side by side with in peace and harmony. It's a lesson to anybody who doesn't think that Christianity and Islam can peacefully coexist. Volgograd, the history of that battle, formerly Stalingrad, to see the Motherland Calls statue at Mermayev Kurgan and just feel the shudder down your spine as you understand the scope and scale of the sacrifice that was made by the Soviet people in defending their nation against the scourge of Nazi ideology. I went to Grozny, as I said, to meet the Chechen people. I went to Sevastopol on Crimea to see that. And I finished up in Sochi. Sochi, a city that has been built, redefined through billions of dollars of investment. It's still growing. It's a top-notch city. And all along, I met the working class of Russia, the real people of Russia, people that make Russia work. And we had frank and honest and open discussions. And it was just a wonderful tour. I hope that I can do the Russian people justice in the work that I'm going to try and do now that I'm home, to try and transfer what I saw, what I learned to the American public, to the Western public at large, in an effort to overcome the disease of Russophobia that seems to have gripped our collective societies.
Well, you're doing it here very well. Jenny in the YouTube chat asks, did Scott get any hassle on his return at the airport? Did you?
Yeah, of course I did. But I will say this, it was expected. You know, you can't be somebody with my profile, my background, and travel to Russia and not be expected to be subjected to some severe questioning upon return. But I will say this about the Customs and Border Patrol officers that I dealt with. They were extremely professional. They were courteous. They were cordial. And they were professional. And there was no, this wasn't, you know, something done with bad intent. They were doing their jobs. They did their jobs very well. And we parted on very good terms. There's no resentment on my part for anything they did. I mean, it was inconvenient to be held up for several hours, but that's life.
Let's turn to the war. The tactics seem to be, I mean, the spring counteroffensive never happened. Maybe it'll be a summer counteroffensive, maybe a winter one, maybe it'll never happen. But the spring one didn't happen. But new tactics were deployed. The Russians called them terrorist tactics, and some of them undoubtedly are. They would meet any objective criteria for terrorist acts. The Russians seem, I know this for a fact, and you probably do too, the Russians feel that the British are egging on the Kiev regime into more and more acts of individual terror, which, of course, is ironic, as countries like Britain are never done accusing other people of being terrorists.
There's no doubt that the British are playing a leading role in advising the Ukrainian government, and in particular the Ukrainian intelligence services, on the conduct of this conflict. And the British are specialists in playing the role of the underdog, that is to be the side that has less power, but to seek to use unconventional means to maximize potential. They were behind the attack on the Kerch Bridge, and they're behind the current onslaught of drones against Russian cities. But again, they destroyed civilian infrastructure and they killed civilians. There was no military, impact of these actions on Russia. What the British, I think, have failed to understand is that they are giving Russia the green light to strike what Russia calls the decision-making centers. I just ask people when they keep telling me Russia invaded, there's a war. Guys, there wasn't a war. There isn't a war. If there was a war, there would be no such thing as a decision-making center still in existence today, because they would have been destroyed on day one. Russia has had a soft hand in this. The fact that Russia has had to increase the scope and scale of its activities is because NATO has made the decision to pour tens of billions of dollars of military equipment backed by intelligence, operational training, planning, and British hands-on efforts to inflict harm on the Russian people. So there is an escalation that's taking place. But just imagine if Boris Johnson hadn't flown to Kyiv in March of 2022, and that the Ukrainians had sat down in Istanbul with the Russians on April 1st, as they were planned to do, to sign a peace treaty that would have brought an end to this war and allowed Ukraine to retain the territorial integrity of at least Zaporizhia and Kherson, and Donbas would have been on the table because it wouldn't have been absorbed into Russia. Imagine the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian troops would be alive today, the tens of thousands of Russian troops, the tens of millions of Ukrainian civilians that wouldn't have been displaced, the millions of lives of the children. No one talks about the children whose lives have been disrupted. They're not getting the education they need. They're not getting the stability that everybody says is a mandatory part of child, you know, raising. No one talks about this. All of this would have been avoided had the British not intervened. The British government is soaked in the blood of the Ukrainian people. The British government is solely to blame for the suffering that's taking place right now. And I think the Russians are getting fed up with it. They're tired of the rhetoric of Ben Wallace. I mean, if you want to talk about a man who is self-indicting himself as one of the most egregious war criminals in modern history, it's Ben Wallace. And, you know, one can only hope that at some point in time in the future that justice will be brought to bear on people like Wallace and others who have been encouraging this conflict.
I had hoped to tell little Ben that at the Oxford Union in a debate where he was slated to face me, but he didn't have the courage to turn up. What happens next now in the war? Assuming no offensive breaks in June, do the Russians relentlessly push forward? Do they seek to, as it were, mop up in the Donbass and entirely consolidate their control there? Or do they take the war to Odessa along the coast, liberate and fortress Transnistria and so on? How ambitious are Russia likely to be now in this conflict, in your view?
The longer this conflict goes on, the more ambitious the Russians will get. I mean, one of the things that isn't appreciated is the level of restraint shown by Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. You know, there are many people in Russia who are chomping at the bit, so to speak, to have Russian forces capture Odessa, which they view as a Russian city, to have Russian forces link up with Transnistria, getting rid of that, that geopolitical nightmare, to capture Kharkov, Dnipropetrovsk, Sumy, these other Russian cities, to bring an end to Ukrainian oppression of Russian culture, language, religion. But the Russian government right now seems to be intent on liberating those territories that it has absorbed into Russia proper and focusing on that effort. Now, this is a very bloody process. I think the battle for Bakhmut proves this. If the statistics put out by Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner group that carried the brunt of the fighting, are accurate, and there's no reason to doubt this, 75,000 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in that battle alone. Another 100,000 were wounded. The amount of equipment destroyed is mind-boggling, the damage, the destruction done to the city. And yet that's just one city. There's still 35% of the Donetsk Republic, the Donetsk territory, that is in the control of the Ukrainians. And Russia has said that they are going to take that back. The Chechen forces, the Akhmat forces, are being redeployed into this area to carry out offensive operations to continue that. So it seems to me right now that Russia is focused on liberating the territories of Russia and limiting their offensive action to that. But they are carrying out strategic air campaigns designed to disrupt any potential Ukrainian counteroffensive. They're killing Ukrainians by the bushels. And I don't say this with glee in my heart. I say it with all the pain that that must be mustered when you talk about needless death. But the Russians have said that one of their goals is demilitarization. And they had hoped to get the Ukrainians to do this in as less a violent a way as possible, to remove the stain of NATO from Ukraine. But NATO has insisted on painting Ukraine NATO blue and white. And so the denatoizing process is going to be very bloody. It means the physical destruction of the Ukrainian army, and that's happening. There's another aspect of it, which is denazification. And I think this is going to require the collapse of the Ukrainian government, but Putin doesn't seem to have committed to this, that there is still the potential, at least it appears, for a negotiated settlement if Ukraine is willing to accept the reality of what Russia has accomplished. My concern is that the West won't allow Ukraine to accept this reality, and that this war, which should come to an end in late summer, early August, which is the time where I believe the Ukrainian armed forces will have exceeded ability to sustain this conflict. But if it doesn't and it continues, I think that the next phase will be Vladimir Putin giving the green light for further acquisition of Ukrainian territory. But right now, as things stand, I believe the Russians are willing to accept a peace settlement, a termination of this conflict that limits Russian territorial gains to Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Lugansk, and Crimea.
Well, they're having a peace summit in Paris. The only problem is Russia isn't invited to it. How can you have a peace summit during a war when one of the parties to the war is not wanted on voyage?
Well, I think what this proves is that there is a split between the Ukrainian government and its NATO and European supporters. This conflict is unwinnable. NATO now realizes that. They realize that their investment is in vain, and that if they continue to go down the path that the trajectory of this conflict is taking, that Russia will succeed in not only destroying the Ukrainian army, but destroying the bulk of NATO's military infrastructure, especially that which has been given to Ukraine. And so in order to avoid this scenario, I think that there's pressure being placed on the Ukrainian government to come up with, to accept Russia's terms, to limit the damage that's done not only to Ukraine, but also to NATO in terms of reputation and in terms of capacity to wage war. So I think that's the scope and scale of the peace summit. It's an internal dialogue between Ukraine and the West. Russia will be part of this process once Ukraine and the West can agree on what peace should look like.
It'll be there like Banquo's ghost hovering over the table. Scott Ritter, good to have you back on this side of the world, our side of the world, if only we could be more proud of our side of the world. But we're proud of you. Thank you for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows, as always.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Our next guest is Professor Glenn Deason, who is a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway and the editor at Russia in Global Affairs. I've spoken to Glenn many times. He's a very learned man, and his compass of understanding is second to none in European academia, in my view. And so when the NATO, Kosovan, Serbian rumpus began this week, I knew that we really had to find Glenn to hear the truth and the background to where we are now, and where, perhaps more importantly, this is all going to go. So Professor Glenn Deason, thank you for joining us again on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Let's start with, if we can, how we got here. Many people will be surprised that with NATO's many duties around the world, from the South China Sea to Colombia, that there's hundreds of them in a tiny protectorate, for that's what it is, called Kosovo, which is part of Serbia, and that they are there against the wishes of the Serbian government and people. Explain that conundrum, if you will.
Well, it's been a... first of all, let me say, yeah, good to see you again, George, and thank you for the kind introduction. This whole story began with the NATO's illegal invasion of Yugoslavia in 1999. When they invaded without a UN mandate, because they argued that Chinese and Russians were threatening with a veto, which meant that they could override the United Nations. Also it's worth noting that even Henry Kissinger pointed out that NATO was looking for an excuse to bomb by effectively sabotaging their own peace accords with the Serbs. Anyways, after the invasion, NATO set up Kosovo more or less as a protectorate. They were able to get some legitimacy for it, though, by getting a UN mandate, which was 1244, and this was still what NATO refers to as its legality for being there. However, this mandate recognized the territorial integrity of Yugoslavia, which is now Serbia. So, but what happened over the next year since 1999 was the Serbian population in Kosovo was largely ethnically cleansed. They were all pushed out, except for the north. In the north of Kosovo, it's still a Serb majority, and this has been what NATO sees as a challenge, because NATO then illegally recognized independence of Kosovo in 2008. They still rely on the mandate 1244, which recognizes the territorial integrity of Serbia, but nonetheless they have violated that mandate themselves. So anyways, over the next few years, the EU attempted to normalize relations between Serbia and Kosovo, which Serbia and the UN doesn't recognize as a state, which was in 2013. And this is part of the format was to have this community of the Serbian municipalities in northern Kosovo. However, a decade later, the government in Pristina never implemented the agreement and has been trying to cement its control over the north, which, of course, the Serbs would fear. That brings us to the conflict we're currently at.
Exactly. You and I both know the Serbian people. When Djokovic wrote on the front of a television camera, Kosovo is the heart of Serbia, he meant it. And all Serbs mean it. They cannot possibly allow further dismemberment of what is now merely a rump of what once was Yugoslavia.
No, and that's also been part of the strange position of NATO, because the NATO forcefully took Kosovo from Serbia, which was the first time after the Second World War, we changed the European borders by force. When we speak of the northern parts of Kosovo, the NATO countries have been quite opposed to allowing it to stay in Serbia. So they're suggesting that, northern Kosovo secession from Kosovo is not permitted, even though technically they wouldn't actually secede because they're really a part of Serbia. So it's a big game of who's allowed to secede and who's not allowed. So it's a very strange game they're playing. It's effectively similar as what's happening in Bosnia.
Strange indeed, though, Glenn. Let's pan out a bit. Who is allowed to secede and who is not allowed to secede? So Kosovo is allowed to secede, but Catalonia is not. And Crimea is not. How do Western politicians and your academic colleagues square that circle? Because it frankly sounds absurd to the ordinary person.
Yes, and it is absurd, because what they effectively did was introduce this principle of self-determination, that this should be allowed to override territorial integrity. So now you've introduced two competing concepts. You have territorial integrity or self-determination. And well, which principle should work and or should it go with? And it turns out that, well, whatever power interests would dictate. So, for example, in Kosovo, we need secession. In Crimea, no, it's territorial integrity. In Taiwan, they're pushing towards secession. So it's all very much, you know, presenting two different competing concepts and then choosing the one that fits their interests. So people don't really appreciate how devastating this invasion was, because after the invasion of Yugoslavia in 1999, it was argued that it was not legal, but it was legitimate. And this is quite extraordinary, because this was when we decided to decouple legality from legitimacy. And one has to ask the question, and what makes something legitimate? Well, it turns out liberal democratic values. This is, again, a very vague reference to values. And who represents it? Well, it's the NATO countries, the US and its allies. So in other words, when making this claim, it's the West that gives itself a prerogative to create an exemption for itself in international law. So, you know, we can interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. We can topple governments. We can invade. We can change borders, because now we are acting, you know, according to liberal democratic values, which allows us to exempt us from the normal international law, which other countries have to follow. So whenever we talk about this rules-based international order, this is what we're talking about, this sovereign inequality between states. And it has its foundation in what was done in Kosovo.
Yes, which in turn flowed from the pen of Mr. Tony Blair and his Chicago Doctrine with his terrible twin, Bill Clinton. But here I'm detecting something that I'm going to dive more deeply into on another occasion, but it does seem to me that in the Yugoslav War and the breakup of Yugoslavia, the British were far more aggressive and determined on war than the Americans were, that Blair was more hawkish than Clinton. Ditto in the invasion of Libya, where Cameron and Sarkozy were quite a bit more gung-ho for war than the Obama-Biden administration. And now we're seeing all that repeated again in the Ukraine, where Biden says, don't attack inside Russia. Britain says, do attack inside Russia. It's perfectly legitimate to do so. In other words, maybe we need to recalibrate our fire on the US-UK relationship. Maybe the UK is actually, perfidious Albion, is more close to the heart of these world problems than we perhaps assumed in the past.
Well, you're correct that there was Tony Blair who argued that, you know, in this new era of liberal hegemony, he said we've moved beyond the Peace of Westphalia, which was, you know, the recognition of sovereign equality of states. And his advisor, Cooper, who argued, you know, we need the liberal empire again. We need to have a garden, protect the garden from the jungle. So again, going very back to this imperialist rhetoric. Now, But you're very correct though with this with the British. It's quite, for me, it's I'm not quite sure why the British becomes more hawkish than the United States. But it was also Tony Blair who, after the Serbian television criticized being bombed in 1999, he argued that this was war propaganda, which justified bombing the Serbian media. And of course, thereafter, the Americans bombed the Chinese embassy when they also complained. But we see also the same now in Ukraine, of course. It's very strange that it's always Britain who comes out the hardest. They called for attacking inside Russia. They're the one who's sending depleted uranium ammunition. They're the one sending the long range weapon systems. It's quite interesting that this is Britain on the front line.
Yes, it may be a sort of me cry now that we've left the European Union and we are desperate for attention But on the other hand, it's placing British people in some danger and their interests in very grave danger. But as I say, I'm going to dive more deeply into that on another occasion. Back to Serbia for a minute, Professor. Where does this go now? Vukic has stood down as the leader of the ruling party in Serbia. There are elections. I think he's not going to contest them. There are big social movements on all kinds of things, family values, and the issue of mass shootings and so on. There are a lot of currents at play inside Serbia. No Serbian leadership can afford to sell out Kosovo, can they? Any more than they can afford to, for example, sanction Russia. No government could survive in Serbia that did either of these two things, let alone both of these two things.
No, I agree. And this is kind of the problem for Serbia. On one hand, no Serbian leader can, surrender Kosovo. On the other hand, they don't want a war with NATO either. But in my opinion, if they're forced and pushed to a corner, I think that they would deploy a military force if required to protect the Serbs in northern Kosovo. So it's my expectation, or how I see this, is that the Serbs will try. They have a strong incentive to walk this. To soothe their relation, the tensions, if it's possible. And I think that the benefit now is that it appears that NATO might that they also want to reduce tensions. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that over the past month, the NATO countries have been quite responsible for provoking this, because for months now, they've been putting immense pressure on Serbia to make concession on the Kosovo issue, and also to force Serbia, by the way, to put sanctions on Russia. Now, this is what the Serbian president has complained about for months as well, that they never experienced this amount of pressure before. And even the U.S. ambassador to Serbia confirmed in March that the U.S. was making Serbia, quote, pay a high price for its reluctance to impose sanctions on Russia. So the U.S. committed itself to keeping up the pressure on Serbia. And there's been also many publications in the West that this is an opportunity now with the war in Ukraine, that they can put a split between the Serbs and the Russians as a condition for NATO to establish an exclusive sphere of influence in the Western Balkans. So the reason why this has contributed to this escalation is, you know, how does the Kosovo Albanians react to this? Well, they saw that NATO has effectively given them unconditional support since 1999. And so now the authorities in Kosovo saw this as an opportunity to escalate, to cement their control over northern Kosovo. However, the Serbs in northern Kosovo pushed back, and Serbia put its military on high alert on the other side of the border. So what we're actually seeing now for the first time is NATO countries, then especially the United States and France, criticizing the government in Kosovo for having incited this conflict, and also now pressuring and punishing them in order to de-escalate. So again, this is something entirely new. So I don't see NATO wanting or can afford to make this escalate into a war. But again, they wanted to bring pain to the Serbs with max pressure. But now that NATO seemingly wants to de-escalate, it might be an opportunity if they're able to control Kosovo, that is, because the government there, you know, they've had for the past, since 1999, they had effectively the assumption that NATO would defend them or support them no matter what. So they haven't really had, they've expected that they can get anything they want. So this is also a new situation for them. And it remains to be seen if they are willing to de-escalate.
Professor Glenn Deason, thank you as always for joining us with your wisdom and your eloquence on this subject.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Fra is in Belfast on Kosovo. Go ahead, Fra.
Hey, George. I'm going to talk about Kosovo, if you don't mind, via Beirut. I'm just back from a conference there. It was a global gathering in support of the Axis of Resistance, And it was held for 4 days in Beirut, as you know, a very beautiful city by the sea. The people at the conference, you know, represented, there were various groups, including the popular mobilization units in Iraq. There were people from Iran, people from Lebanon, people from Syria representing some of the government and foreign departments. And among the people that were attendees was a lady from Serbia. So I got the chance to chat to her. Dragana was her name. And she was telling me part of the history, obviously, of the breakup of Yugoslavia and the attack on Serbia and what's happening in Kosovo today. Like, she has absolutely no time for the present administration in Serbia. And some of the things she told me along the lines of, you know, that the Kosovo Liberation Army had originally been designated as a terrorist organization by the USA and was then de-designated as such.
And by Britain. And by Britain. Robin Cook designated the Kosovo Liberation Army as a terrorist organization before turning our air force over to them.
And very much like what's happening in Ukraine, they then use the Kosovo Liberation Army in a proxy war against Serbia. And she was telling me that it was really when the Serbian military security apparatus, including the Serbians in Kosovo, and were on the point of crushing the Kosovo Liberation Army, that NATO then stepped in. Its proxy was being defeated, and NATO then stepped into the breach in order to save them, and then went on to bomb Belgrade. But she told me an interesting thing, George, and I have no reason to doubt her. She's a very intelligent and very, very well-placed person politically. She said that Kosovo only has like 5,000 combat troops, and it was something to do with, I don't know if it was a peace deal with NATO or what came out of it, but they are limited in the amount of soldiers that they can have at arms. And she also said that the Serbian government was sending munitions to Ukraine, and it also supplied Saudi Arabia for ISIS in Syria. So while, like a lot of politicians say things in public, in the background, there's all these Machiavellian machinations and how they adhere in secret to be carrying out what she considered to be American policy in the region. So just wonder what you thought of that.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that that's true of the Serbian government, though, of course, I'm familiar with the accusation. If you send us her details, Dragana, if she's a good speaker in English, and we'll get her on the show, Fra. Thanks very much for that report, drawing the absolute parallels that exist between the Kosovan question and the Ukrainian question. Michael is in Washington on the issue of world leaders. Let's hear what Michael thinks of them. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, George. Firstly, the Brits being more hawkish, that's a Terry Thomas protocol, isn't it? One-upmanship, I think.
Yeah, one-upmanship in a very deadly way, making our people the number one villain in the world. That was your job, Michael, in the United States. But at least you're protected by the Atlantic Ocean up to a point hitherto. But we're not protected at all. We're a sitting duck, a sitting target, with no means to defend ourselves beyond, if America allowed us, unleashing nuclear weapons, bringing about the complete end of our country. Some defense, that is. Go on, Mike.
These so-called leaders, I have two brief questions. One is that, is it possible, and you've known a lot of these guys, is it possible that in their elderly age and in their positions of power, that they have it as a fantasy in their mind playing out that if they eliminate young men, they're going to gain the, limited competition and gain the admiration of young women? Is that a possibility?
Well, Joe Biden likes them young, preferably children. So who knows what goes on in the minds of these people? I think in the case of the British, it is a bit of me, me, me. Look at me. These European Union backsliders are all umming and eyeing and on the one hand, but on the other, maybe we better be careful and so on. So the British run out in front of the Americans and say, look at me, I'm ready to go even farther than you. And it may be as pathetic as that. It really may be. It certainly can't come from any calibration of Britain's national interest. That is the complete opposite of Britain's national interest. It cannot be because we think we could fight and win against Russia, against China, against both of them together. It cannot possibly be that, unless they've forgotten about these long ago events in Afghanistan just a year or so ago, when the Americans slunk out like a thief in the night from Afghanistan, the British having already slunk. We couldn't beat guys in sandals on bicycles with Kalashnikovs, but we can beat hypersonically nuclear-armed superpowers. Aye, right, as we say in Scotland. Michael, thanks for the call. A legend is on the line. Clear the lines. It's Norma in Bristol. Go ahead, Norma.
Hello, George. I didn't really mean to phone again, you know, so quickly, but I'm a bit worried.
You're always welcome. Always welcome.
On the news today, they were talking about these Ukrainian children, many of them, that have been evacuated to Russia to supposedly summer camps, mm-hmm. and then later their families had to travel miles and miles to get them back, and they didn't all come back. And I want to know what this is all about, because basically it's, I wouldn't have thought it was altruistic to do that, and you know, it's been a bit concerning, really. Have you heard about it?
I'm not sure. I know the story. I mean, maybe they're training the children to be handle beluga whale, former spy whales. I mean, we really are getting into the realms of the ridiculous now, Norma. Why would Russia want to kidnap Ukrainian children? Why? For what purpose? Children are not going to be able to fight in the war or work in the factories or, I mean, what would be the point of it? It is such base, vulgar, childish propaganda that it's amazing that anyone believes it. But Norma, they do. They do believe it.
George. Hello? Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I'm saying they do believe it.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, they showed these parents and people traveling miles and miles, and they got their children back, and they were very concerned about them being taken in the beginning. And it was all pictured on the news, so it's bound to be true, isn't it?
No, it's not bound to be true. How can you say that after listening to me all these years, Norma? Of course it's not bound to be true. This is a propaganda psychological war that we are in. These stories are psyops. And if even a wise and dedicated woman like you says it's bound to be true, that proves that it's working, Norma. Think.
Yeah, but
we'll talk later. I've got to make way for another legend. You know, you're not the only legend, you know. But Tommy in Glasgow from our diplomatic wing wanted to have the last word, but we haven't been able to get him. Tommy, call back. Bigfoot on YouTube says, first we had Chinese spy balloons. Now we have a former beluga Russia spy whale. That former that gets me. Next, we'll get Chinese spy Big Macs. Well, this Russian fertilizer is, of course, fertilizing everything. How do we know that that fertilizer doesn't place surveillance equipment in the Brussels sprouts? that will be on our dinner tables come Christmas time. How do we know that? Russian fertilizer, up to no good. Now, the poll results are overwhelming. Is Roger Waters being smeared? 88%, 95%, 97%, 95%. 12,302 people voted across all platforms. Roger, you are vindicated as if you needed it. You're a great man and you deserve all the love that is coming your way from good people all over the world. Now, I was expecting Tommy on the line, or I wouldn't have had to cut Norma short. Norma, please forgive me. It was a clash of two legends, but Tommy has disappeared. I'm very sorry about that. I feel very strongly about the media, as you know, but I feel strongly that we're really onto something. I gave you the viewing figures for the last 7 days. This is on a budget so small that you would laugh if I told you what it was. You would laugh that this show with that audience could be built by that amount of money. And so when I saw somebody called George Galloway had won £300,000 on a scratch card and started to get newspaper calls to ask if it was me, I thought to myself, well, good luck to the George Galloway in Glasgow that won £300,000 on a scratch card, which I had described at the time. They were launched as the crack cocaine of the gambling business, a view to which I hold. But it was quite funny that everybody thought that it was me that had won it. That man in Glasgow called George Galloway has probably had problems over his life having that name, and I'm sorry if that is true. But my point is, somebody would back me. What could we build this into? What could we build this mother of all talk shows format, brand, into when we've got more than 2.25 million people watching the show over 7 days on virtually nothing, with no investment, with virtually no income? Just think what we could do if we had an anti-war chest. If you're out there and you've won a scratch card fortune, or if you're out there and you have a business that you'd quite like to be showcasing to such a large audience, please write to me at onair@moats.tv. There he is, Glasgow couple. Say their £300,000 win has left them in complete shock. Congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Galloway. It couldn't have been us because we don't do it. So I'm glad that it was you. If you're out there and you can help build this Moats brand, just think what we could achieve. Because I'm not satisfied with 2.25 million. I won't be satisfied until all over the world people are making a regular date to sit down live and watch the mother of all talk shows on Wednesdays and on Sundays. I'll be back, God willing, on Sunday at the earlier time, please note, of 7 p.m. UK time, where we'll be across all these burning issues and bringing you the best guests and guests that you'll never find on the BBC, even sitting on the back of a beluga whale. Good night.